How are we now?
We
are
good. Okay, Lord have mercy.
Okay. Word has it that when the Buddha first began to teach, he was really kind of a dud. Wasn't much good at it. First off, the folks he ran into after he became enlightened, who had been practicing with him before in the woods, one of the things that he had been practicing in the lifestyle of an extreme ascetic and sort of literally starving himself, as had been the other people that he was practicing with. And one of the things that made it possible for him to achieve a more balanced view and actually become free was nourishing himself. And so he had taken a little food to give himself the energy to achieve his goal. So some of the people he'd been practicing with saw him, and they said, "What's up with you? It looks like you've been eating." Cheat. You know, you don't have anything to teach us because you can't even keep the rules. And basically what he responded to them was, you know, if you get so attached to the form, you forget what its intention is. And at some point you even need to let go of the form if you really want to be free. And so they were having none of it and they abandoned him. And so he went on for a while, just sort of going his own way and hanging out, and when he'd strike up conversations with people, and eventually some folks really became very interested in what he was teaching, people who were serious spiritual seekers themselves. And so this small gathering, small group of people gathered with him, and he began to roam around and teach. But it was really slow going at first. And one of the reasons that this was so was that they put the word out, you know, that, well, the Buddha's going to be offering these teachings in this place, and the teachings are about achieving spiritual freedom and becoming enlightened, you know, becoming free. So people would gather around to hear what he had to say, and he'd start saying stuff like this. You are of a nature to grow old. You've not gotten beyond aging. You are subject to illness and infirmity. You've not gotten beyond illness and infirmity. You are of a nature to die. You have not gotten beyond death. All that is yours, dear and delightful, will change and vanish. And then finally, what goes around comes around. You're going to experience the consequences of everything you've ever done in your life, you know, good, bad, or indifferent. As you might see then, not a big hit. I mean, this was not what people came for exactly, or not what they thought they were going to hear. And so it's like, whoa, I think I've had enough with that sutra. I'm going to go back and reread the Kama Sutra instead, you know, something that's kind of more fun. Even though it hadn't been written yet. And it was only with the people who really stuck with him, who really were willing to deeply investigate in the way that he had. I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to do this. I was going to speak loud tonight. So, how on the one hand can you have advertised teachings that are about spiritual freedom and about becoming enlightened and whatnot, and then when someone is seeking to learn more, they get a message like that? What the Buddha was teaching and what I just recited were what's called the five daily recollections. And he said that that keeping these kinds of things in mind is indeed a path to freedom. Okay. Because it has the effect of gradually teaching you the importance of letting go. Okay. He was offering a teaching that in classical Buddha Dharma is called the three marks of existence. Okay. All things are impermanent. Okay, and that's the one that I just got through talking about. The Pali word is anicca. Okay. Ceaseless change. Nothing is permanent, nothing is static. Everything is always in flux. So, impermanence, and another of his characteristics of existence that he taught was insubstantiality. You know, that phrase that I recited a few moments ago, all compounded things are impermanent. By that he means anything that's made up of other stuff. Basically, everything in the material world is undergoing ceaseless change. It's not static, it's not solid, and it therefore has no substance. It's like clouds in the sky. The realization of these two things, then, impermanence, ceaseless change, nothing the same, nothing to grasp onto, nothing to hang on to. And insubstantiality. Nothing is real or solid in a way that we like to think it is or that we would like it to be. Okay. That the realization of those two things for the discursive mind creates a real sense of distress, a real feeling of unsatisfactoriness. Okay. Pali word for that is dukkha. The Pali word for insubstantiality is anatta. Anatta meaning sort of thing or isness or something. Anatta meaning not that. Okay. And specifically with regard to human beings, anatman means not self. Okay. That in his culture, in his time, just as is the case for us, we've been raised in any of the Western spiritual traditions, and certainly in the Brahmanism of his time, that there is a permanent and abiding self, okay, a soul, you know, that basically has spiritual substance. And in the teachings of the time, you know, that this Atman would move through different incarnations on the goal toward purification and becoming one with Brahman. The Buddha taught that in his experience that just was not so. Okay. So this notion that nothing has ultimate substance and that all is in continuous flux, all is ceaseless change, is very insulting to the discursive mind because it really doesn't want to believe those things or see them to be true, with the result then that there's distress and there's a sense of anxiety and unsatisfactoriness, or dukkha. And so he really was teaching about freedom, and he really was teaching about the possibility of becoming enlightened in this lifetime. But he said the way that actually occurs is by letting go of the idea that anything is solid and stable and eternal. By letting go of the idea that things are real and solid and have substance. By letting go into the flow of experience. By surrendering to these forces of ceaseless change that are going on within us, just as they are in all matter in the universe. When I was just finishing My PhD program, I was attending a newly established PhD program at a highly regarded Western public public university on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. Kind of moved up through the ranks and passed the various exams, and had written my dissertation and had been signed off on, and it was, you know, in a big research university, that's pretty close to the top of the heap insofar as student being a student is concerned, right? And so my entire life had been focused on getting this dissertation written and getting it, you know, approved by my committee and getting it filed and whatnot. And I did it, you know, and it was done. And suddenly there was this huge hole in my life where all this activity had formerly been. And I was fortunate enough to find a teaching job. We'd been living in the San Francisco Bay Area for, you know, a long time, 17 years or so. And I'd found a teaching job, a temporary one, at another nearby university. And what I realized, and I was supposed to have been sort of at the pinnacle and launching myself into this teaching career, and yet instead what I felt was really sad and really anxious, and I didn't know why, you know, a little depressed even, very kind of shaken, spiritually shaken. And a friend of mine in the Bay Area was also one of my Dharma teachers, Jack Kornfield, was also a psychotherapist. And so I went to see Jack as a client a few times to see, you know, if he could help me work through these powerful and unpleasant emotions I was going through. And what we did in conversation is that he was able to show me, in terms of these three marks of existence, what was going on. He said, what I would like you to do in your home office, you know, I was setting up to go start teaching at this other UC campus. And he said, I'd like you to get a little vase and put a cut flower in it. Okay. And look at the flower every day, you know, when you're working on your lesson plans and whatnot, you know, and appreciate its appearance and its beauty and its fragrance and whatnot. And I'd like you to keep it on your desk for 10 days. What happens to a cut flower over about a 10-day period? It wilts and it withers. And that which had made it attractive, it no longer is. It doesn't smell so nice after a while. Maybe it starts to attract gnats or something, you know. And so you throw it out and get another one. What he was trying to convey was this process of change, you know. I had become extraordinarily attached to this role that I had as this graduate student ascending through these various stages of completion of the program and all that. And suddenly, having achieved that pinnacle, now I was, you know, a temporary low-ranked instructor at another campus, another place. And so it's like I'd been up there and now I was going down there. And I was having to let go of who I thought I had been back then and start constituting a new identity for myself in a different setting. And it was a really powerful teaching, both to note that all these changes that I've been so looking forward to, all of a sudden, they weren't so great when they were happening. And in fact, I really missed, and I found myself almost grieving for the life that I had had before. And I found the one I was now constructing for myself, you know, it was kind of scary. And I didn't really kind of know who I was. You know, it was like a little chick being popped out of an egg, kind of, you know, and I was having to start figuring out again who I was in this new setting and constructing a new identity for myself, right? And starting that process all over again. And It was powerful and it was disturbing, and it was also enormously helpful because I was able to see clearly in a way that I hadn't really been able to before how I had so carefully constructed this identity that suddenly it's gone. Insubstantiality. Now you see it, now you don't. You know? Anatta, that self which had been created, was no more. It was gone. And Jack and our mutual friend and Dharma teacher Joseph Goldstein wrote a book that dwells a lot on this subject. And they write, impermanence, look at it right in this moment. A sound comes and then it's gone. A thought arises so quickly and then passes away. Sight, taste, smell, touch, feeling, they're all the same, impermanent, fleeting, and ephemeral. Where is yesterday? Where is last year? Where is our childhood? It all vanishes so quickly. If we want to understand death, we have only to look at the present, because in each moment we are being born and dying. The sound we just heard is already gone. It died, and we died with it. To live fully is to let go and die with each passing moment, and to be reborn into each new one. So I could hear and understand that teaching at the same time that I was madly trying to construct a new identity to attach to. The message evidently, the lesson didn't kind of sink in all the way at the time. And it turns out I've been needing to relearn that lesson pretty nonstop for the last 30 years or so. June of 2016 will mark the end of my 30th year as a professor in the School of Public Affairs at the University of Colorado. And it's also, that's the year in which I turned 70. And so it's occurred to me that that's probably a pretty fitting point in time to resign my position at the university and to do just the opposite of what I did back then, you know? This carefully constructed identity over the years is about to be set aside. Okay. And so in some ways it feels like sort of coming full circle, you know. It's one more identity to have to let go of, you know. Carefully constructed over the years, and now suddenly no more. We find it difficult to accept the truth of impermanence. If we'd stop and look carefully, we'd see that it is the very nature of our lives. We cannot stop the body from constant change, and we cannot stop the mind from constant change. When we want things to be other than they are, we are bound to be frustrated. As practice develops, so too does the vision of impermanence deepen. As we learn to acknowledge our aging and our death and all other change, we live more fully in the present moment. You know, folks that I know who have had life-threatening illnesses, you know, cancers of one kind or another, oftentimes have told me, you know, I can't necessarily say that I'm grateful for having had this condition befall me, but it was in some ways a great gift. Because what it did was to teach me experientially the absolute necessity of letting go if you want to be free, you know, of just living as fully as possible in the present moment, because we surely do not know what the next one holds in store. Jack Engler, a Harvard psychologist who has studied meditation, has described the growth of wisdom as a process of grieving. Why do you think he's done. Why does he say that?
Yeah.
Yeah. He has described the growth of wisdom as a process of grieving. Spiritual wisdom. Yeah.
Letting go of all those illusions.
Yeah. Right.
I'm sorry, letting go
of. Letting go of delusions, you know. Letting go of, again, who we think we are, who we thought we were, you know. Being willing to live fully in the moment without clinging to identity. Okay. Being able to live fully in the moment, recognizing the unsatisfactoriness that is caused by desperately wanting things to stay the same, by desperately wanting things to have substance. And they don't. To come to terms with outer change at this level involves a tremendous process of letting go. Yet it is a task of all humans and an immediate necessity for anyone who would live with a wise heart in this world. So, perfecting the art of letting go seems to be part of the price of freedom, the way the Buddha talks about it, you know, of kind of a willingness to acknowledge that which we don't necessarily want to. I mean, there are all kinds of ways that we continue to live in a deluded state without really knowing it. You know, and not just us individually. You know, one of the things that I have, you know, the more I've studied it, that I have found to be just profoundly, amazingly, almost incomprehensible, is the extent to which, if you have any faith in the scientific method, you know, we have all the leading climate scientists in the world telling us that we are in the early stages of the worst environmental disaster in recorded human history, you know, and that we caused it and only we can turn it around, you know. And yet, we've diselected a majority of people of the Congress who have chosen to believe that this is not true. I mean, it's an extraordinary act of delusion, you know, to somehow think that you can legislate away the behavior of the cosmos if you don't find it to your liking. You know? And various of us, you know, in our own ways, we kind of do that too. You know, it's not, it may not take the form of climate change denial, but there are probably things about us, you know, that fall a little bit into the same category. Things about us that if we really had a closer look, we would recognize, you know, that in some way or another, maybe minor, maybe somewhat major, ways in which we're kind of living in denial, you know. A bunch of years ago, a fellow named Danny Goleman wrote a book called Vital Lies and Simple Truths. And the vital lies were the stories we tell ourselves that we find comforting, but at some level we know it's not really how it is. And so this waking up, you know, is to a significant extent about, you know, what are the ways in which we've been kidding ourselves, you know, what are the ways that we've created a little cocoon around ourselves in terms of beliefs that really don't really quite hold up so well, you know. Certainly, you know, in the Mahabharata, you know, it says, you know, and the fellow goes forth in search of his dead brothers, and he finds his brothers' bodies around the feet of this ogre, and who says, "Well, you know what? Your brothers came to me, and I asked them a riddle, and I told them I would let them pass if they could tell the truth. If not, I would devour them, and you can see what happened to them." So the ogre said, and here's the riddle, you know. What is the most wondrous thing in all the world? And the young man says that we can see death all about us, yet think it will not happen to us. And of course, the ogre had to let him go. So, right, yeah, it's going to happen to us. And that can come across as a real bummer, you know, absolute downer. It can also be, you know, quite freeing. Just to, and that's what the Buddha was trying to get at, you know, with the five daily recollections and his teachings on the three characteristics. You know, this is not intent, and that's why to the outside, you know, Buddha Dharma looks like kind of a glum downer of a path because of the kinds of stuff that's being brought up and it's having light shown on it. But he's saying is no, not at all. The truth of impermanence, the truth of insubstantiality, is not disturbing, is not anxiety provoking. Necessarily, it all depends on how you look at those things. If you're viewing the truth of insubstantiality and the truth of impermanence from the perspective of the discursive mind, from the conjured self, major bummer, you know, real downer. Okay, but if it becomes possible, every once in a while, maybe when you're sitting and the mind gets really quiet, you know, quiet to the point where you're not conjuring the self and you're able to just say, right, you know, all is in flux. There are myriad things about me and within me that I cannot control whatsoever. Okay. It's kind of like being on a whitewater rafting trip, you know. You're just kind of ripping along and, you get, and there may be some minor adjustments you can make. But by and large, you're just riding this great flow of force and energy through the universe, you know. And we seek to do it as gracefully as we can, for as long as we can, never knowing what's around the next bin. Suzuki Roshi once said, life is like setting out to sea in a small boat you know is going to sink. And if you can kind of go forth with knowing that, right? It can be disquieting, depending on how we're seeing it or hearing it. It could also be leavening or lightening, you know, when we realize that that's so. Yeah. So please, let's, anyone that has any reflections or questions, now's the time. Let's speak of these things.
Your passage of leading to wisdom resonates with me. I have been carrying this cliche in my head since adolescence. There was something like, good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment.
Well done, well said, okay. So let's say it again, please.
Good judgment comes from experience.
Good judgment comes from experience.
Experience is the root of bad judgment.
Yes, experience comes from bad judgment, right. Right. Why is it that the most important lessons almost always seem to be the most painful ones, right?
Yeah.
Well done. When the Buddha spoke of that, it was like ripening fruit, you know? That seasoning, that growth process certainly has that element in it, you know. There's some pretty interesting parallels too from some of the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth, you know. Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow, they toil not, neither do they spin, yet I say unto you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed as one of these, you know. If the Creator bestows such care on these simple lilies of the field, why not, you know, then surely He will bestow the same care on you as well.
Yeah. It seems to me that one of the 10 factors of enlightenment is the the setting aside of the belief in a permanent and abiding self. And that's one that's interesting to me. It goes back and forth. It's, well, did the Buddha really believe in reincarnation or not? And reincarnation is, in one sense, a variation on the Christian teachings that I grew up with, which is, oh, your soul will be in heaven.
Yes.
Now, you may not come around again, but you are going to persist.
Yes.
And it seems to me that's a rather central belief for Buddhism.
In my study and my experience of the area and the teachers I've sat with, it is a subtle dynamic. You don't hear, certainly in the Theravada tradition, you don't hear any of the teachers speaking about reincarnation. They speak about rebirth. In the Tibetan tradition, they do talk about reincarnation because part of their belief system is that some of their, and especially in the traditions that practice guru yoga, that some of their teachers are reincarnations of past teachers, right? And so that's, but it's a lot closer to the Hindu view of things. And certainly, at the Buddha's time, there was, the extant belief system at the time was Brahman, the Godhead, and Atman, the spirit of the spark of the divine in each of us, and you move through these successive reincarnations, you know, Atman does, in a state of constant purification until finally you become purified to the point where you become one. Brahman and Atman become the one, you know, and you kind of move into the universe. And that was their language, and that was the system that the Buddha was born to, and it's the system, you know, when he talks about when you're reading in the discourses, and they're at the beginning where they say there's a collection, it said various Brahmins and recluses gathered together to hear the Buddha speak. These were people who believed in reincarnation. The contemporary scholars, people, you know, when he talks about this realm of teaching, they prefer to use the term rebirth because the term reincarnation leaves the impression that there is this entity that stays the same, that moves across lifetimes and whatnot. And that's not really what the Buddha taught, actually. It seems that, you know, when you look at the similes that he would use for what happens, you know, it's like when a candle is about to burn out and you take that candle and you light a fresh one. You know, it's not a thing that moves from one place to another. It's a process. You know, it's the process of combustion. It's like the transfer of information across space and time. You know, so I say a word, you hear the word, it may have to you the same meaning that I intended it to have when I spoke it, as far as a thought that arose in me of speaking a sentence in order to try to convey some intention to you. You hear my speech, and the way you take it in, the way you understand what I said, may or may not be reflective of my intention insofar as an idea that I wanted to share or see if it kind of resonates with you or you have some understanding of it. And so one way of understanding this process is just that, the conveyance of information across space and time. And for people in the Theravada tradition, who I know of, who actually, you know, their concentration is such that they're able to, and this includes Asian teachers that I've had who have distinct memories of times long ago and far away, or these five-year-old kids that can recite arcane sutras they've never seen before in their life. You know, there's something at work there that we don't have a good theoretical explanation for. But the Buddha did not speak as explicitly about some entity moving across generations in the way that the historical Buddha didn't speak of those things in a way that some of the other traditions now do. That's pretty much the limits of my own understanding of that.
So the, what's being said by rebirth is not a birth again of the same entity,
right?
But it's a birth of another iteration of a human personality.
Mm-hmm.
So that there'd be no continuity between the two.
Some consciousness, some transit of consciousness, mm-hmm. some perhaps means by which information can be conveyed over space and time. And for people who I know who practice deep samadhi a lot, who spend great periods of time in the experience of not self, you know, whose consciousness is kind of marinated in or saturated in the experience of not self over long periods of time, have sort of conveyed to me, you know, the possibility of touching upon perhaps memories of a bygone time, you know, but it's like, so it's more like their consciousness has gone to visit somebody that they may have been related to a long time ago, but it's not as if I was that person. You know, if you look at a photograph of yourself as a child, okay, you say, oh, that's me, you know? Well, kinda, but not really. That's a little kid, you know, who's related to you in terms of your genetic material, you know? But there's been a lot of life experience happen between, you know, between then and now, you know? We hopefully have some wisdom or understanding now that we didn't then. Maybe we had more wisdom and understanding then, we just didn't have words for it. You know? But so you can think of that as kind of a continuum, you know, across time, and then also a continuum across space. You know, when sometimes when the samadhi gets really deep, the appearances of separateness or of difference, you know, that for the most part are what we focus on, you know, age, body type, gender, ethnicity, all these things by which we tend to identify each other, you know, seen from another way, are quite superficial, you know, compared to these very, very essential similarities that underlie it all. You know, I've heard it said we're not humans having a spiritual experience. We are spirit having a human experience, you know. Just kind of dropping in to see what it's like for a little while. Yes, please.
This emphasis on lineages in a lot of Buddhist...
Emphasis on?
Lineage.
Yes.
Would you elaborate on that? I mean, how does that fit in? Is it the same as this continuum, this text-based time continuum, the same as the lineage or not?
It's held different ways in different traditions, teaching lineages are. And that's where some of certainly in the Tibetan tradition, the notion of reincarnated teachers comes from. And certainly in Zen, it's very explicit in terms of what they call Dharma heirs. You know, if somebody is acknowledged as a person authorized to teach by a Zen master, okay, then it's part of their lineage, you know, like family almost. In the Theravada, it's held a little differently. The way they do it is that because they rely very heavily on the historical record, on the Pali Canon and really, you know, ancient texts, whenever somebody takes robes and takes up the way of life of being a monk or nun, or certainly actually just the monkhood right now, one of the things they learn is the recitation of their teaching lineage going back to the Buddha. So it's somewhere between about 75 and 80 generations of teachers. And they need to know the names of every one of those teachers. Right, you know, from the Buddha right down to Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Buddhadasa and whoever took over from them. So they take that stuff pretty seriously, you know. And for them, it's the preservation of the root, you know. But not in the same way that it's held by the Tibetans necessarily, or even the Zen tradition. But insofar as the practices are concerned, what they've been doing for 2,500 years is wishing, may all beings be happy, may all beings be peaceful, may all beings be free, may all beings now alive, may all beings yet to be born. So they've been sending their loving kindness forward across the generations, across time, to us. You know, just as we do when we do metta for those yet to be born. Yeah, you know, so there is that kind of connection, that kind of system.
It seems like there's such an equalizing feature to the five recollections, just in the moment now, not just over time, but like remembering that I'm subject to old age and infirmity and everything I care about will go away. And looking at the people that are really getting hit hard by climate change.
Yes.
The violences that are going on and even the good things. That is me. I mean, it's that. At least in the moment right now, that feels like it really is me. It's not like it's just something that always happens to someone else or over mm-hmm. there or whatever, but that same thing will be happening to me at some point. It is my fate too. And I don't know, it just struck me as being very present.
Yeah. Let's see. I can't remember the name of the Zen teacher, that maybe one of you can. To study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to open to all things.
Dogen.
Dogen, yes, thank you. Thank you very much. It can be enormously freeing just to let go and to recognize that the boundaries and the barriers between us are illusory. But what it also then does is open us up to the, in a more poignant and personal way, the suffering of people dying from Ebola and the courage of the people who are treating them, of the people living in low-lying areas whose lands are being taken from them and have nowhere to go. For those of us literally, who bear major responsibility for the turn that things have taken insofar as our environment and what we need to start trying to do about now, even though the odds seem pretty steep. What's the alternative? Well, I went and gobbled up most of our time, and I had hoped we could get at least one song in here. I think maybe if it's okay with you, we could just sing one song together. There's some music sheets, a little songbook back there if you want to take a copy. The reason I brought up change tonight was because of its cyclic nature. We're coming up on the solstice. It's a time of change of the seasons, and I'm thinking maybe it's okay with you, the one of the songs that's on there is a one that Pete Seeger wrote from the book of Ecclesiastes. Turn, turn, turn.